Hi there, friends, and welcome to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik. Thank you very much for tuning in today, spending some of your time with us today as we highlight what we consider to be some of the most interesting and important topics that there is to focus on and study. Our website is redicecreations.com. Go there if you want to hear more radio. We have a year of radio available for free for you on our website. If you want more, you can always sign up for a membership to our website. We have programs going back to 2006, extended interviews with many of our guests. We also have webcasts, films, and video interviews available there for you. And today we are going to spend some time together with Terry Boardman. He is a UK-based researcher and author of Mapping the Millennium: Behind the Plans of the New World Order. Terry is also one of the speakers at the upcoming AV2 conference, the Alternative View, that is in London Heathrow at the end of May. We're coming closer to this event as each day passes, obviously. So if you are interested in attending, you should definitely get on board now for the sake of tickets availability. We from Red Ice are going to be there, and we hope to see you there as well, of course. There's a lot of great speakers there. Some we've had on the show. You can always go back into our archive and check out some of the recent programs that we've done with them. And the website that you should go for more information about the Alternative View is simply thealternativeview.co.uk for dates, tickets, full list of speakers, and so forth. I also want to mention Terry's website, monju.pwp.blueyonder.co.uk, and this will be linked up on redicecreations.com for easy access. We're going to spend a little bit of time here today talking about the New World Order, but from a kind of a little bit different perspective. We're going to talk about the importance of the 21st century, the new millennium that only is 9 years young, as it were. We're going to talk about the meta picture, the big game, as it were, and it's going to be very interesting hearing more about this from Terry. So with that, welcome to the program, Terry. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Henrik. It's nice to be with you.
Excellent having you here. And I do want to talk a little bit about your background here right at the beginning and introduce you, as it were, to our listeners. Tell us a little bit about when you got involved in this particular area and how long you've been studying it.
Right. Well, I got involved in it really towards the end of the 80s, I would say. But perhaps if you just allow me, maybe I just spend a couple of minutes building up to that so I can put this interest arose in a biographical context. Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
Because I'm coming from the west of England, and I was born, however, that's the boundary between Wales and England, so Anglo-Celtic background in my family also. And I was born in Wales, at the south, and I was brought up off the border, and I was brought up in Chester, the north of the border. And that's interesting because these are two of the three places that had Roman legions 2,000 years ago. There were three Roman bases in Chester, and two of them were in the places where I was born and brought up. And the place where I was brought up, Chester, which means camp, Roman camp. Mm. This is a very, very historical city. It goes back to 79 AD. And one is very much aware, you know, I was aware as a kid, brought up in the late 50s, early 60s, of the history of the place. So that's just to flag that up, first of all. Very, very strong connection there with Rome, you might say. And then because I had TV from very early on in my childhood, and in those days television was very Americanized in Britain, so I used to watch a lot of TV as a kid. And around about the age of 8, I used to watch, for example, quite a few war films, and I became very struck by the fact that the way that the Germans and the Japanese and also the Red Indians in these films were not treated fairly. They were treated as some subhuman or as, you know, not rather stupid.
Yes.
And this had an effect on me already as a child. So I was about 8 then, and that was the beginnings of my interest in history. And then just coming forward a little bit, around about when I was 11, I was very much into Tolkien then. Your listeners will probably know about The Lord of the Rings and Hobbit and all of this.
Yes.
And about the same time, I also went on my first foreign trip. It was a school trip to Austria. And that period was the beginnings of the my interest in the First World War, not the Second, which is perhaps a little bit strange because being born only 7 years after the Second World War, England in those days was very much awash, you might say, with memories of the Second World War. It was very close.
Mm.
And we still had a movie industry in those days in England, lots of war movies. But no, I was interested in the First World War because I had family connections which went back to then. And so that time, the BBC also made a 50-year retrospective of the First World War, a very long series, which was like a new world opening to me. So I had three new worlds opening to me at that time. One was Tolkien, one was Austria, and the First World War. And then a fourth one, which is also again through TV, was The Samurai. I saw this film, The Seven Samurai, of the famous Japanese director Kurosawa. And that was another completely different world which opened up. So these are the beginnings of my interest, you see, in what you might call the German-speaking world and the Japanese world. Then I went on to do karate later on when I was a teenager. And then eventually after university, I went to Japan. And I spent 7 years in Japan as a language teacher. And that was really perhaps the most formative experience certainly in the first part of my life until now, what Japan taught me, various personal qualities it taught me. But from the point of view perhaps of our theme today, one of the things it taught me, which I think is very important, is to become aware of one's national conditioning and to become aware of also how one's thought processes operate. And the national conditioning element, if I may just give you an example of that,
please,
is that, for example, we in Britain here, we live on an island, obviously, and we are sort of educated almost subconsciously from early childhood to think that we're individuals, you see. And so I have my personality, I have my individuality. And so then I noticed fairly soon after I went to Japan and they would ask me questions, all kinds of people from university professors to taxi drivers, whoever it would be. And they would say, well, things like this, we in Japan think such and such. What do you in England think about that?
Right.
Yeah. And I would always reply, well, there are 55 million of us.
Yep.
I can't speak for them. I think this such and such, you see. I'm sure you as a European can also understand such a point of view. I mean, it's fairly typical in the West, yeah,
absolutely,
as a whole. But it took me, Henrik, about 2 years almost to be in Japan before the penny dropped, as we say in English, which is that for the Japanese people, and this was the early 70s, remember, this consciousness that we think in this way was a reality. So I began slowly to realize that I myself had been formed by my society to have this view that I was a personality and I could only speak for myself and I was almost isolated, you might say. Whereas they felt themselves to be strongly a community and a community that shared certain values and beliefs and thoughts. So that was a very important lesson because when I came back to England later on very briefly in the 70s, but especially in the early 80s, I realized, talking to my friends and looking at the media and so on, that there were all kinds of prejudices and habits and customs of thinking which the English actually had and shared, but which they were not aware of because they thought of themselves as individuals. Whereas, in fact, they were often looked at things in a very equally collective manner. It's just that it just wasn't so conscious for them as it was for the Japanese, paradoxically.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, then I came back really with three questions from Japan. Because it's such a very different culture, you know, that obviously it's got all the technology that we have and more. And yet that's, in a certain sense, at that time in particular, was on the surface. And underneath was a way of thinking and acting which is very, very different.
Yes.
from the West. Many people have noted this, yeah. But I explored all sorts of things in Japan. And I came back from there with three questions, really, because I was really trying, out of my interest in history, to understand this tremendous dissonance or polarity between the Far East and the West. It seemed to me that there was no way to bridge. And I asked all kinds of, came into all sort of different spiritual streams, for example, in the East, and also read a lot. And I couldn't find there any satisfactory answers to the question of, well, what then is the West? Do you see?
Yeah.
That the representatives of Japanese spirituality would say very politely, well, the West has actually been a mistake. The entire evolution and history of the West has been a mistake. And in order for you to become healthy again, you have to become like us. And I somehow knew in my guts, knew in my bones, that this was not right.
Yeah.
But because I'd had, like many young people, a superficial Christian upbringing, and like many young people also in the West, I'd rejected Christianity about the age of 18 and not bothered to think much more about it. I suddenly, after being in Japan about 7 years, this question of Christianity and the other things that differentiated the West from Japan, such as why was it the West that developed natural science and the Far East did not? Why was it that the West did not develop the idea or live with the concept of reincarnation and the Far East did? Questions like this. And those are really, Henrik, the three big questions I had. You know, why doesn't Western science investigate pre-birth and after-death experiences? In other words, why is there no reincarnation in the West?
Right.
And of course, it's just been starting, one could say, particularly since the 1960s. But still, nevertheless, in the general culture of the West, reincarnation has not yet put down, one could say, deep roots. So why was that? The other questions were, what then is Christianity? Because I realized I didn't understand it.
All right, yeah.
And what is natural science? Those are the three questions I came back with. And having not found any answers to those questions in Japan, I came back we were living in London at that time. And very, very soon after coming back, I came across the work of Rudolf Steiner and Anthroposophy. And that struck me as very interesting because here I could see some answers to these questions.
Exactly. And if you will share with us a little bit about what you've found then, because on the surface level, as you talk about this, to me, I've always felt that, in a kind of, I guess, a little bit superficial way, but the East for me has always represented more of the internal, and the West has always represented the external, meaning that we go into the material stuff, the hard science, as it were, as you described. We're interested in the external world, while the East has focused much more on the spiritual things and the internal world. And I guess what you're also describing here as well then is the, how do we put these two together? How do we balance these two sides that actually have, you know, been at war with each other and going against each other, as it were?
Yes, indeed. And one could say that, you know, in a very, perhaps a somewhat superficial way, but there is a certain truth to it, that there is a kind of very large-scale yin-yang between the East and the West, you know, in the sense that you've just outlined, this internal and external. But I think there is a sense that amongst people both in the East and in the West, some people who wish to perpetuate this yin-yang, if you will, into something fixed, so that when it comes to anything of a spiritual nature, we must only look to the East, and when it comes to anything of a technological nature, well, then the West will have the solutions. I had come to feel that from my experience in Japan, that this was no longer a way to see things. And I'd long had my doubts about it. And as I got further into Steiner's work, for example, I came across some very interesting phenomena, which I'd never come across before in my understanding of Western history, which explained why this yin-yang, if you will, this inner and outer, had taken place. And if I just might refer to two of those, they relate to one of my three questions, which was, why do we have no reincarnation in the West? And that is because Steiner made a particular point in drawing attention to two church councils. Ecumenical history, the history or ecclesiastical history, is not something that we study much in school in England. I don't know about Sweden, but certainly I never studied anything about it until I got to university. And even then, I didn't really come across these two councils, and we weren't taught about them. But the one was the Fifth Ecumenical Council of 553, which anathematized or excommunicated or damned the teachings of Origen, one of the early church fathers. And he was somebody who was very much interested and concerned with the pre-existence of souls, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So in 553, a council called by the Emperor Justinian, who was very much concerned to develop a unified church, like a bit like, you know, as the Nazis used to say, ein Reich, ein Volk, ein Führer,
right.
one people, one empire, one leader. Yeah?
Yes.
Justinian had a certain similar view that he really needed to draw his empire together, in which there would be one emperor, one way of understanding Christianity only, and of course ruled by himself. So he called this council, and there were various disputes going on, and as a result of this, it was demanded at this council that these ideas of pre-existence of souls, which implies obviously one has a previous life, that this would be damned. So from that period, the 6th century, 553, this idea began to disappear, you see. And then Rudolf Steiner draws attention to a second council, the 8th Council of the Church. This is the very interesting one, because this council really was the last possibility, in a sense, perhaps, for Western people to discover the concept of previous lives for themselves. And this mm-hmm. was the 8th Council of Constantinople, 869, the year 869.
Mm-hmm.
And in this council anathematized and damned another individual, the Patriarch of Constantinople, Photius, who taught a doctrine of, or was interested in, the doctrine of the two souls. And this way of putting it, the doctrine of the twin souls, was the very, very last remnant or residue of the idea that the individual spirit, the individual has a soul and an individual spirit, and through this individual spirit you could find your own way into the spiritual world, you see.
Mm.
So this doctrine was damned, and it was said that we do not have two souls, we only have one soul, with a few spiritual and intellectual faculties.
Mm.
But the main point of this Council, Henrik, was really to make the individual dependent upon the dogmas of the church.
Yeah, absolutely.
The teaching of the church, so that you were not able to find your own way to the spirit.
Hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And so this was the year 869. And I did my own some research into this, and I found some very interesting things. Namely, that this council was mostly concerned with administrative questions within the church, but that this the laws of this council which were passed, there were some 21, 22 of them, and it was law number 11, which is called Canon 11, which was slipped in to this list of laws passed in a rather devious way. And the whole thing went through on the nod, as we say in English, with no discussion.
Right.
The council lasted several months, but it went through on the nod with no discussion. And the whole way that was done was rather sinister. And its background, because it came from Rome, this proposal, and to the council at Constantinople, it makes an interesting story. I just want to draw your attention to the fact that this was a profound issue of dogma, do you see?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It had profound consequences. And yet it was slipped in to this council in this rather underhand fashion. So this question, and Steiner draws repeated attention to the importance of this council. When you put that together with the other one, 553, you see there something which many, many people, and I'm thinking particularly people in the conspiracy world and in the alternative theory world, the alternative history world,
right,
really have tended to overlook, or maybe they just haven't, were not aware of it.
Sure, sure.
That, you see?
And there is a, do you see this then as the kind of, I guess what you're talking about here is like the initial processes of this, the New World Order structure in one sense. This is to get people dependent on the system and not to go to their own spiritual essence for, well, salvation and healing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's right. And you see, as a result of that, for example, because human beings were in the West were now no longer, this is where the East and the West split, do you see?
Mm.
That before the 5th century, the 6th century, for example, the idea of pre-existence of souls was there in the West. We know the Celts, for example, were into this, and other cultures within Western culture as a whole. But from this time, from the 6th to the 9th centuries, we see this parting of the ways between the East and the West. So the East carried on with its own spiritual processes of individual meditation and what have you, and also concepts of reincarnation and karma. And this door was closed to the West. Now that is a profound historical gesture and turning point, because what it then meant was that those human beings were now who still wanted to find the spirit were not allowed to do that in an internal way.
Mm.
And if there were any people who tried to do that, the church tended to then siphon them off into convents and monasteries.
Yes.
And almost sort of lock them up, so to speak. But there were others, Henrik, who didn't go in there, and yet carried on in a different way to try to find their own way to the spirit, and that then led them to seek for the spirit in the world of nature.
Hmm. I see what you mean.
They look for the world in the world of what was conceived of as the world of the Father. They weren't allowed to go to the world of the Holy Spirit.
Mm.
They weren't even allowed to find the Christ in themselves anymore. So they looked for the world of nature in the world out there, yeah, the
yeah.
world of measure, number, and weight, eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And that, combined with what then came from the East via the Crusades and so on, the Arab, the Islamic knowledge, the translation of the Greek texts, and all of this, yeah,
mm-hmm.
then fuses together at the end of the Middle Ages to bring us to the early 17th century and then the takeoff of natural science as we understand it today in the West.
Hmm.
But if the church had not closed that door back in the period between the 6th and 9th centuries, that wouldn't have happened.
And so on one level then, what you're talking about here is that this has also served a higher purpose as it is, because as you're describing this, I see that there is a reason for this, and actually a positive outcome of that, because of that these things actually occurred and happened, because this gave people the opportunity to go into different paths and to bring out some, well, new information, if you know what I mean, in regards to the relationship with nature and so forth.
Exactly, Henrik. And you and I wouldn't be talking to each other over the internet if this hadn't happened.
That's right.
Because, you know, there would not have been the technological developments in the West, from everything from steam engines to computers, that there have been. So in other words, this technological development had to take place. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a certain part of the world, in a sense, had to specialize in that. Now, some people will say, yeah, but what about the Chinese? They developed paper, they developed gunpowder, they developed printing. And Francis Bacon in the 17th century drew attention to precisely those three things. Yeah, he didn't mention China, but he said, you know, these are the three great technical developments that have happened.
Mm.
But they do all happen to be Chinese in origin. Yeah?
Right.
So people will say, well, doesn't that prove that... you know, the Chinese have been just as great at science and technology as we have. And the answer to that, in a certain sense, is yes and no. And the no is more interesting, because what the Chinese did that in a certain sense by observing nature. But what they did not bring to their observations of nature was logic.
Mm.
They did not bring to their observations of nature what the West has developed from the Greeks onwards, and which was then translated through Syriac and Arabic and brought back to the West and so on. Do you see? Mm. So that this is what led the Chinese knowledge to be, as it were, unsystematic and not to lead further than those developments which they made. And indeed, from about the 15th century onwards, when the Chinese, in fact, stopped investigating the world, you know, their great fleets stopped sailing around the world, they retrenched, they turned back inwards again because of their own spiritual perspective on things. Yeah.
It's almost like also get this idea that the Dark Ages also kind of enabled this in one sense. This term is tossed around, of course, and it wasn't only, you know, a very dark period. There were developments happening and progress happening during this period as well, of course. But it feels like we had this a world that was more in connection with each other before that point. But after that, the church, for whatever reason they had then, decided to cut us off from the world, and we became more isolated. We had diseases and a lot of these things that happened. But this has, as you described, has enabled us to go into the direction that we currently are in. The question, though, is that a lot of people say, no, technology is actually, it's evil. You know, we shouldn't look there. This has only caused problems in the world, and this is even what the New World Order now is using to help to control people. What would you say to that?
Gosh, you raise a lot of points there. Let me try and take them one by one.
Right.
First, about the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages and technology. It is very fashionable today, and has been since the 18th century, since the so-called Enlightenment, to look down on the Middle Ages and look down on the Dark Ages and say this was an ignorant time, as you say, pestilence, disease. Look at the wonderful Arabic civilization, they say, how civilized that was, how scientific that was, and so on and so forth. Mm. But it's not all a black-white picture. Yeah?
Sure.
One has to see, if Europe was not developing this outer science in the Middle Ages, what then was Europe actually developing? And one can see that what Europe was developing in this period of the so-called Dark and Middle Ages was the culture of the individual. And that culture of the free individual, even though that is a culture of a free individual which is cut off from the spirit, it was a free individuality which grew in the soul. It was deeply, deeply personal. And it was through meditation. When I say meditation, I mean a devotional meditation. Yeah, not quite in the same way as that meditation is understood in the East, but through the relationship with Christian spiritual paths in the Middle Ages, the Westerners, Europeans, developed an intensely personal, very strongly personal culture, and also at the same time a very strongly social culture. So I'm thinking, when you think of things, for example, like the guilds, the medieval guilds, and the way the workers would help each other in those medieval guilds based on Christian teachings and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that in the Middle Ages, the medieval period, what Europe and the West gained through its relationship, it's a very painful relationship. I'm not saying that wasn't the case. It's a very painful relationship through the domination by the church. But there was always an underground spirit of what, for example, people like Steiner would call an esoteric, almost a hidden Christianity,
yes,
which sustained people.
Yes.
And that grew and developed through the Middle Ages, and that also then emerges, you see, in the modern world, and then we have this very complex interweaving between that and the world of natural science. And I want to come forward now, try to come forward to what you were saying about the New World Order.
Yeah.
So.
And their use of technology today.
Yes. Yes. So. This question then, you see, of the role of technology. So what is that role of technology? Where is the human being in technology, for example? How do we make a personal relationship to technology? I found, for example, in Japan that the Japanese have, from their Shintoist point of view, all the elements are divine. Metal, water, wood, You know, everything is divine, and therefore nothing is to be feared. And so for them, they will say, why are you Westerners so afraid of robots? You see?
Yeah, right.
We Japanese are not afraid of robots. We quite happily make them, you see?
Right.
But I felt quite early on from my time in Japan, and that feeling was only increased as I went on, yeah, that actually the people of East Asia do not, in their development of technology, they have not, I feel that there is something which they are not perceiving within the world of technology. And the world of technology is a world, particularly since the development of electricity, and maybe you could say more about that later, which I feel that they are not seeing what the essence of that is. And it represents something which the Westerners feel is indeed, how can I put this? There is a sinister aspect. There is a dangerous aspect
yes,
to it.
Yeah.
And that element has gone right through Western culture since Mary Shelley and Frankenstein, you know,
yes,
as many people have pointed out. But there is a sense in which, in the West, in which we are aware of this, how can I put it, not ghost in the machine, but demon in the machine, so to speak.
Yes,
yeah?
Yes.
And how to work with that, right? Now, that comes to quite profound questions, if I just go back a minute to the church,
mm-hmm,
because again, it's not a clear-cut black-white issue why the church cut the West off from spiritual research in that early period. Steiner points out that before the church really turned rotten, so to speak, which was around about the 12th, 13th century, as an institution, you could always find pretty bad popes before that, but as individuals.
Right.
But as an institution, Steiner points out that really the church had nothing more to do in European culture after the 13th century, that the church functioned within European culture as a kind of wet nurse, as a kind of civilizing force for the barbarian tribes from my part of the world and yours, from Scandinavia, from northern Germany, the so-called Germanic peoples, right, who attacked and then overwhelmed the Roman Empire. And the church fulfilled the function of somehow carrying on some of, obviously not all, the gifts and the treasures of the pre-Christian civilization, from the Greek times, from even some of the Gnostic things, that these were carried on through the church, and also of course the institutional questions, the whole concept of law and all the rest of it. Yeah,
yes.
That was one of the functions of the church, and that was justified, so to speak, that the Germanic tribes had lots of energy, but there was a sense in which they wanted to be civilized, and they were in effect civilized, in inverted commas, by the institution of the church from about 400 until 1200. But after that time, this new European humanity, you could say, post-Roman, had come into a new stage of its development, which I could mention later. And then from that time on, the church turns really, really bad. And that's when we start to see things like the crusade against the Cathars. We see the development of the Inquisition and so on. Yeah.
Mm.
But I just mean that before that time, in this time of which I was speaking about, the 5th to the 9th centuries, it was not necessarily all, you know, that everything that the church did was bad. And Steiner points out that there were individuals, and it's always a question of individuals here, that there were individuals in the 9th century who could see, who had, as it were, a certain kind of clairvoyance, a certain kind of farsightedness, and they could see that something would need to come into European development in the future, and that which needed to come into European development was materialism, and that technology and technical science would need to be developed in the West, and for that purpose the West needed to be cut off from the Eastern Orthodox stream, the stream of Byzantium, which contained all of these contacts with Asia, do you see?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happened. This is what happened in the Council of 869. This is why Photius, the Patriarch of Constantinople, was anathematized. And this is where the beginning of the split took place, Henrik, in the year 869, in the 9th century, between the Eastern Church and the Western Church. And that was then came to conclusion with the so-called Great Split, or the Schism of the Church in 1054, where the two churches anathematized each other, Constantinople and Rome, mm-hmm. and then they stopped talking to each other, they excommunicated each other, and that goes on still today.
Yes.
They still have not formally forgiven each other, do you see? They're
getting closer. Yeah, they are. I mean, there have been deals here and there, but I get your point.
That's right. But the reason for this was that there was a certain amount of, as I would call it, initiate knowledge, even within the Roman Church at that time, that Europe had to go down this dark path for a time, that materialism would have to come into European culture for a time, and that therefore a certain door would have to be shut off, do you see?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is quite a profound thing if you think about it in the whole context of European development. Yeah?
Indeed.
And it's not just, you see, it's not just a case, as one sometimes hears in alternative circles, of, oh, right from the year dot, you know, everything about the church and all its works was negative, and they enslaved humanity, and it's been horrendous from that time until this. The human being in the West has gone through certain changes, through certain stages of development, and the church accompanied it up to a point, and then came a point where the church's role was over. And then, of course, comes the usual problem, that those people whose role is over don't recognize that, don't want to recognize that, and then try to hang on to power.
Right. Well, I see what you mean. Do you think then that this is in some way divinely guided, these things, or are these philosophies by men still that consider, okay, this must take place at this particular time for the human race to develop into these two different strands, if you know what I mean?
Well, perhaps we could say that there's a sense in which I would say, Henrik, that the Christian church had to go through its own – the essence of Christianity is crucifixion and resurrection. And that means that the Christian religion has to go through its own crucifixion and resurrection. And that's what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
That is exactly what's happened and what's happening. So we have seen, and we are seeing still today, the church, particularly since the Protestant split, but we've seen the Catholic Church has betrayed Christ, just like Peter betrayed Christ. And we've seen the Catholic Church under attack. And we're seeing all of the churches, we're seeing churchianity, if you will, under attack. Yeah.
Mm.
But those people who would wish to kill churchianity, I would say they would be making a big mistake if they're thinking they're also killing Christianity. Because in a sense, the real Christianity lives within the hearts and spirits and souls of individuals.
Right.
And that is what is actually happening now. That has been happening in the modern world, that people are now coming to they're feeling very carefully forward to their own experience of what Christianity is, who Christ was, and of its relationship and Christ's relationship to all of the spiritual streams within world history.
Mm.
So the end of the age of churches, yes, but not the end of the ages of what I would call of what Christ was about. And so if you ask, is this in some way divinely guided, then in the sense that the church has to go through its own crucifixion as its own resurrection, I would say that is profoundly spiritually or divinely guided. Yes,
it's a very, very interesting perspective to look at things, because again, I like this idea that you don't look at it as black and white as this. There's always, you know, the yin and yang in everything, as you described before. And even if we look at the question of the Middle East and as the kind of the gateway to the East, do you think that this has also been an important area because of its, you know, the importance here have been to control this area in order to keep the two sides separated. That's why they sent the Templars down there, and that's why even to this day, perhaps then, that we're seeing this area as being, you know, there's a lot of violence in the area. They're trying to keep people, in one sense, away from there, if you know what I mean, in order to have the two sides separated. Do you think that could be the case as well?
Steiner pointed out in the First World War, he said that the two sides that were fighting in the First World War, although it was horrendous, that there was a certain sense in which this idea of the Entente powers fighting the central powers of Europe, this is an illusion. And that what's actually going on was in a completely other place. The real struggle was going on in a completely other place. And I would say something similar is happening now, that when we are told about the war on terror and that this is based in Islamist terrorism, I was hearing Tony Blair talking about that on the radio just today, that, you know, the West is fighting, in a sense, a struggle against radical or fundamentalist Islam, then this is a complete illusion. I would say this struggle is totally illusory, and the real struggle is somewhere else. It's at a deeper spiritual level. Perhaps we could come to that later. But
yes.
I just point out that it's very interesting that when we think that really there are three great world faiths or world religions in the world, yeah, there's Buddhism, Islam, and Christianity. And when I say three, I mean very large ones, yeah.
Sure,
Which are you could say cosmopolitan. They are not specific to one particular culture in the way, for example, say that Hinduism is,
yes.
Or even arguably that Judaism is, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that these three are cosmopolitan, and one sees, for example, that 600 years before Christ, you, approximately around that time, there is some dispute amongst historians when exactly it was, but let's say from that time on, somewhere between 600 and 480, we see the stream of Buddhism coming out of India. And then 570, we seem fairly clear, 570 after Christ, approximately 600, we see Muhammad born. So on either side of Christ, you have one of these streams emerging in India, and then the other stream emerging in Saudi Arabia, in Arabia, the Islamic stream. So you've got Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism. And one can ask oneself, well, what is actually the relationship between these three streams? And Steiner pointed out, well, we see an interesting development that 600 years after Christ, Islam appears as a kind of re-emergence of that which was in the Middle East 600 years before Christ. In the Middle East, I'm thinking of Babylonians, Chaldeans, and Jews. Yeah, at that time, the Jews were the Jews returned from Babylon from the second 538 from the second captivity and started building the temple. And that's the 6th century. So that whole stream of Judaism, and then we start getting the whole Jewish Bible is written after that time, yeah. And from that time, we then see that there's a kind of recrudescence, a reemergence of that moon religion, which Steiner characterizes it, the religion of the Near East reemerges in a new form, but very similar in some respects, in Islam, 600 years after Christ. So there's a kind of a balance here, do you see, within history. Yeah?
Mm.
And then he says, well, look what happens then, 600 years later, from 600 years after Christ to the Crusades, 1200, you see the Christian world and the Islamic world in conflict with each other. But that conflict, it's conflict, but it's a bit like, Henrik, teenagers fighting. You know, when teenagers fight, they also fall in love. They play games. They struggle. They swear at each other. They curse. But there's a complicated learning through conflict, you might say.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah? I see what you mean. Mm.
They and in that conflict, the West learned many things from the East, from the Islamic world, but not only from the Islamic world, from all of the Near Asian world, which the Islamic world carried within itself. Yeah, the ancient Persians, the ancient Babylonians, the ancient, all that wisdom. So that was there in that struggle between 600 to 1200. And then he pointed out that the next 600 years, from 1200 to 1800, you then had in Europe, in the West, you had then had the consequences of this earlier conflict and meeting work themselves out. So for 600 years, you had the conflict and the meeting, so to speak. And then you had another phase where the consequences of that worked themselves out. And in the West, what that meant above all was natural science.
Mm.
That led profoundly to the natural science, which then comes forward, particularly from 1600 to 1800, and obviously on into the 19th century and still today. But we can see clearly that Western natural science takes off with the likes of Bacon, Galileo, Descartes, and Huxley. The other great figures of that period, yeah,
yes.
Bruno and so on.
Yes.
So I'm just mm-hmm. yeah, I'm just saying that then. From 1800, he says, we will now find that the West will come into a relationship with a different culture, and that will be the culture of Buddhism.
Hmm.
You see? And if you then see that that which stands under, there's a certain sense in which Islam stands under the sign of the moon,
mm-hmm.
and that Buddhism, there's a certain sense in which Buddhism stands under the sign of what Steiner called the mercurial force.
Uh-huh, right.
So we see that within this particular symbology, that the Christian world, so to speak, comes into contact with the world of Islam, with the moon, and then comes into contact with the world. Let's call it by a shorthand Mercury. Yeah, we can maybe talk about that later, but there's a reason for that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the contact for another 600 years between Christianity and Buddhism, and what do we find now? We find, you know, I mean, I was in Germany last year, Dalai Lama everywhere.
Mm.
Before Tibetan Buddhism, it was Zen Buddhism. Before it was Zen Buddhism, it was Hinayana Buddhism. So there is a real now a meeting and a mixing and a tentative finding out between Christianity and Buddhism going on, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very interesting development over the course of time, which plays very much into the situation with regard to the Middle East, because what it means is that the phase of the working out of the meeting of Christianity and Islam is now over since 1800, and the Islamic world is now challenged to go through a new phase by itself. And I will just touch on something quite interesting here, because there are those in the Western New World Order forces, and I would particularly draw attention to people, for example, one very important New World Order supporting organization is the Economist magazine of London.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And these people are very, very aware of these rhythms and times and periods of history. So you'll find that The Economist draws attention repeatedly, and has done, particularly since the early 90s, and late 80s when I started to get interested in them. It draws attention, Henrik, to the fact that the Muslim world is going through its own reformation.
Hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's going through its own reformation. And that means, when you then reflect that right now, the Islamic calendar is, I think it's something like 1431 or something like that, you know, the Islamic year.
Right, right.
Something, I can't remember exactly which it is, but I think it's something like that, 1431 or 1432.
Should be, yeah.
Something like that. That, in other words, that the Islamic world is going through its own 15th century. It's approaching that time when in the West you started to get Protestantism. You had Wycliffe and then Hus in Bohemia, the first seeds of Protestantism. Do you see?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then you get a major split. That's what happened in the West. Now these New World Order forces in the West today, are saying Islam is now going through the same process, and they're doing all they can to divide what they would call, for example, Shiites against Sunnis, mm-hmm. or so-called fundamentalist Muslims against moderate, that means compliant with the West Muslims. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Muslims who will support the West. Right now, for example, Obama is now talking about following on from Brzezinski, his mentor. He's following on with this idea, well, we have to split the Talibans. Yeah, mm-hmm. Brzezinski is saying there's not one Taliban, there are Talibans in the plural. And that means we have to split the Talibans from those who are fundamentalist religious and those who basically can be bribed, which means those who are prepared to go along with the Western way of doing things.
Yes.
Yeah. So they're looking to split the Islamic community, and they're trying to introduce into the Islamic Muslim intelligentsia and the Western intelligentsia who feel, let's say, akin to the Muslim intelligentsia, who are sympathetic to the Muslim intelligentsia, they're trying to introduce the idea that the Muslim world is going through a similar process that the West went through. That, in other words, that the Muslim world is going through its own, and I've even seen this phrase used, its own puberty crisis. Now, that's very interesting, Henrik, because there is indeed a profound sense, and I think there is certainly truth in the notion that the West went through its own puberty crisis in the 14th century.
Right, right. Well, yeah. this is very, very interesting, Terry. I definitely want to keep going, as it were, on this narrative and talk more about this. I want to ask you a little bit more, what will happen if this quote-unquote problem, so to speak, will be solved, if there's a solution to kind of individual but yet amalgamated church here and kind of where we are now in that process, if that's the case. But so we'd love to continue talking here in hour two with you more, Terry, if you're up for that. But before we do that, though, I definitely want to touch briefly upon the AV2 conference upcoming, what you'll be addressing there. I want to mention your book again, and maybe you can mention your website again as we round off hour one here.
Right. Fine, Henrik.
So go ahead and tell us a little bit about what you'll be. We'll go into this in more detail at the AV2 conference, or we'll go in another direction.
Well, I just finished talking before that in the first hour about this notion of the puberty crisis of the West in the 14th century, yeah? And that relates very much to the question of the 21st century. The Steiner pointed out that. If we look at history, we can see that there is a certain – well, one of the things he brought was that there is a certain new rhythm. Ancient astrology looks at all kinds of rhythms, Henrik, in world history. And one can look at that from various perspectives. You'll find, for example, that on various alternative websites and even some of the conspiracy websites, you can see that people are aware of the idea of the precession of the equinoxes, which means that, we're now – whether we are – in the different ages, we hear a lot about the age of Aquarius, the age of Pisces, the age of Aries, and so on. And these are based on certain astronomical facts.
Yes.
The fact that the spring point rises the spring point moves 1 degree every 72 years, and therefore it moves through one sign of the zodiac in every 2,160 years. Mm-hmm. So we're in a different cultural age, you might say, yeah? Every 2,160 years.
Yes.
And that you'll find that idea in various places. But Steiner also speaks a lot about that. But he brought something from this Christian perspective, because he saw himself as a Christian esotericist, and that is based on the life of Jesus Christ, 33 and a third years. And he said 33 and a third years times 3 makes a century, of course. Yeah?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And the point is that he pointed out that a social impulse, whether for good or bad, that is implanted will experience a kind of – you'll be able to see a kind of resurrection of that impulse 33 and a third years later. And then you'll see a further development of that, rather like from root to stem, leaf to blossom, over 66 years later and 99 years later. In other words, 100 years later. So that means that 100 years, the period of a century, has a certain historical validity to it. Now, that obviously for your listeners, Henrik, that can only be a hypothesis. And I would only say, you know, this is not something I'm going to prove to you now on the show, but it's something I've become convinced of from my studies of history, of the truth of this. Because one way in which maybe your listeners might look at it for themselves is to compare a century of Western history to what happens in the life of a human child. That means if you look at the life of a child, let's take the fourth year, the seventh year, the ninth year, the 14th year, and the 21st year. Okay?
Terry, sorry to cut you off. Yeah. Maybe we can continue talking more about that in our second hour. I want to begin to round things up here for the first hour.
Well, I'm sorry, Henrik. No. I thought we were already
in. No worries. Okay, now I should have be more clear on that then. But I want to mention here again then that you'll be speaking at the upcoming AV2, the Alternative View Conference, at the end of May in London, with a host of other speakers. We'll be there as well. People can go to thealternativeview.co.uk for more information on that. And also, I want to mention your book, Mapping the Millennium, Behind the Plans of the New World Order. That's your book. And Terry, mention your website for us here as well, so people know where to go to. Can people get a copy, by the way, of your book through your website?
You might be able to, yeah. You should. I've got two books, yeah. Mapping the Millennium might be a little difficult to get hold of these days, but it's certainly still available. I mean, I've still seen it up on Amazon, so that's still available. And also the second one, Caspar Hauser, Where Did He Come From? That's certainly available. But forgive me, I just briefly mention that the AV2, I'll be talking about why is the 21st century the most important has been, in my view, the most significant. And also, why is a particular chapter of human history that began around 1600 now ending? What is at the root of the Anglo-American elite drive for world power, world dominion? And in relation to that, what do we mean by evil in the modern world and its relationship to the New World Order? Is the New World Order only a matter of a desire for a few people or a few families for power, or is there more of it than that? What is the actual role and movement of this New World Order gesture and movement in the world, and in related to that, the function of evil in the growth of human consciousness?
Very interesting. So definitely more on that than on the conference. And again, here, your website, do you have an easier URL, or is that the full monju.pwp?
That, I'm afraid, is the full, yes, that is it, yeah.
Okay, well, no worries. We'll have this linked up on our website. But again, for people listening, if you have a pen and paper, the website, Chair's website, is monju. That's M-O-N-J-U, monju.pwp. blueyonder.co.uk. We'll have this up on redicecreations.com as well. So let's take a little break right here, Terry, and then continue talking about this interesting thing about the lifetime of a child when we get back after this break. So stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Thanks.
We are going to continue with Terry Boardman about the challenge that we face as we're entering into the third millennium. We are going to discuss spiritual geopolitics, more on the East and West, that means the US and Russia, and how these powers can possibly be balanced by Europe. We're going to talk about the binary system versus the power of the Trinity. We'll also discuss more on Rudolf Steiner, the New World Order plans and their subversions, and the true desire for harmony and balance in the world. But we'll begin to talk about the life of a child and how it can be viewed in cycles of sevens, and the different stages of development that we go through. So don't miss this very interesting continuation with Terry Boardman. RedIceCreations.com is the website. That's the place to go to find more information about how to join us in the member section if you want to hear more. And also, of course, get full access to our archives of radio, webcasts, video interviews, and more.